Okay, thanks. So it's, I think it's intended to be rather pedagogical and addressed more to the other community. So maybe the N equal 4 people might find this slightly boring, but I hope they will still get something once in a while. But you can go to sleep, and then when I raise my voice, you can wake up slightly. But anyway, this is based on work done with some friends, Andy Brandhuber, who is here, Bill Spence, who is also here, and Valia Cosé, who might be here, I don't know, and some other friends who are not here, Paul Heslop, Babis Anastasio, and Gang Yang, who is very lucky to have at Queen Mary as a postdoc. I want to talk about two main things. The first topic, which will take most of the talk, will be Wilson loops. And it's really intended to be pedagogical. So I would like to show, well, Wilson loop comes into the game because of the connection to amplitudes, which I will review in a moment. And I want to show you in detail some one loop calculation so that you really learn how to perform these calculations. And then I will outline some features of the two loop calculations, which are much harder and where some help also from people who know how to do integrals might be very welcome. By the way, there is a there's an integral on a wiki page which awaits efforts from the audience. And well, I will talk about some general features of the result. Now, depending on time, I think we both plan to go over time, so I might take more time to talk about some very nice result of Drummond, Hen, Korchemsky, and Sokachev, which has to do with with some anomalous dual conformal worded entity, which is very important. So there is an anomaly in this dual conformal symmetry, but as long as you know the anomalies, you can use them, and then these anomalies have also been ported into the amplitudes and are very useful to the to constrain their form. And the last part of the seminar will be about form factors. Now, and Sven will talk much more in detail about such quantities, and that part will be discussed a lot later. So I will only mention some why we ended up thinking about form factors in N equal 4 super young Mills. So let me just say, just as an anticipation, form factors are slightly off-shell quantities. So one of the things which people may want to try is to study more the structure of slightly off-shell quantities rather than just amplitudes. And one of the surprising facts is that these objects, which are, well, let me just write what they are. You basically take the vacuum, take some local operator in your theory, apply to the vacuum, and then project onto some state. So the state is on shell, but the operator is off-shell. So there is one, basically there's one leg which is off-shell. And well, the surprise is that these objects are also quite simple. In particular, they are much simpler than what you would expect from Feynman diagrams. So again, that's something which can capture the imagination and well, our fantasies and dreams, and so on. So we just try to play with simple quantities, simple objects. In N equal 4, there are very special operators that you may want to consider, like BVS operators. And we try to apply some of our beloved techniques, like BCFW recursion relations, MH3 diagrams, unitarity, generalized unitarity, and all of these things seem to work also for these slightly off-shell quantities. And another thing I should mention is that there's some recent work done by Eden, Korchemsky, Sokachev, Heslop, and friends, where the interest has be concentrated on studying certain correlation functions of, again, of special operators in N equal 4, but in light-like limits, where you start taking pairwise all the separations between the operators to be light-like. And there seem to be another duality which relates these light-like limits of correlation functions to scattering amplitudes. So there is some interest also in trying to go off-shell. And maybe the last thing I should say is that in two-point functions, of course, there is a beautiful link to integrability. So maybe, well, that's one of the directions that many of us dream to go. So establish some link also at quick coupling with integrability. Okay. Now, first topic, as I said, is Wilson loops. Which Wilson loops? So the connection with Wilson loops came with this very influential paper of Alden Maldacena, who addressed the question of calculating scattering amplitudes using ADS-CFT. And just the end point of their calculation was that they ended up with the calculation of a Wilson loop at strong coupling, where the boundary leaves at the boundary of a certain T-dual ADS space. And the boundary is a very special form, which I'm just sketching here, which is made of light-like segments, which have to do with the momenta of the particles which scatter. But the boundary is really constructed by, so you take all the momenta and you join them following the order of the insertion of the string vertex operators on the world sheet, or in the language of amplitudes, you concatenate them following the ordering of the planar color ordered amplitude. So what we say here is only large N, and I think Sven will talk also about going beyond the large N limit. And the very nice feature which occurs there is that you can associate to these vertices, some coordinates which came out completely naturally in the calculation of Alden Maldacena. And you can define the momenta to be differences of these T-dual coordinates, xi minus xi plus 1, for all of the momenta. And therefore, you have this specific contour. And their calculation technically ended up to be the same as the calculation of this Wilson loop at strong coupling. And later on, people, Drummond, Kolchevsky, and Sokachev, and then us, we decided to calculate the same contour at weak coupling, the same Wilson loop at weak coupling, and see what happens. And if you have hopes, then the surprise might be nice. And the surprise was that this calculation gave something related to amplitudes. So let me first say one thing about this calculation before we move to weak coupling. So let me write down the result of the calculation that Alden Maldacena performed. So the result as an exponential form. So this part is the result of their calculation. What was not captured by their calculation is some prefactor, which is understood as some subleading correction in 1 over square root of lambda. Now this prefactor can also be vanishing. If you consider certain amplitudes which vanish in n equal 4, for example, the whole plus amplitude or a single minus, this prefactor should vanish. But this is not captured at the moment, at least, by such calculations. So their calculation only obtained some sort of universal part of the scattering amplitudes. The Wilson loop that we have here that we want to calculate at weak coupling is also, certainly doesn't know anything about ellipticities. So you may wonder what is the amplitude that you're going to obtain. But the result will be that this calculation will give something strictly related to the n equal 4 MHV amplitude. Okay? And there will be also a surprise, why do we get n equal 4? Because as we will see, that at one loop, at least the calculation is purely bosonic, doesn't know anything at all about supersymmetry, which is another surprising point. So just anticipating things a bit, let me just write the form of the MHV amplitude in n equal 4, which to all loops can be written as the three-level amplitudes times some function, which depends on the momentum of the particles, but it no longer remembers where your negative ellipticities used to sit. And what will basically, with some subtlety which I want to stress later on, what we will obtain will be this part of the calculation. So the MHV amplitude divided by the three level. Not quite. So I will talk about why not quite, but when we get to loop calculation. And of course, if there are any questions, you can stop me anytime. But I will try to be very simple. So if you don't stop me, I assume it's too simple, perhaps.
Okay.
So what I want to do now is I want to describe in detail this one loop calculation, and then in progressively less detail, the two loop calculations, what are the problems that one encounters there, technical problems. Okay, so now we do one loop. Okay, so the Wilson loop is it's just a bosonic Wilson loop. It's a trace of path order exponential of plus ig, and then there is a integrated along this very special polygonal contour. All the momenta, of course, are null. That's an important feature of this calculation. And, well, I can put factor 1 over n to normalize this properly. So this is going to be 1 plus, and, well, the one loop correction will be, the first order term in the expansion will be 0 because the trace of the generators are 0, and then we get ig squared, and then there will be some trace of TATB, and then there will be the correlation function of two such objects, let's say a nu, dy nu on the contour C. So that's the quantity that we have to calculate in order to get to this result. And here there are also core indices A and B. Now, why am I going to show this? Because it's very simple. So this is really a calculation that can be shown on the blackboard in a seminar. And by the way, when a few years ago we ended up calculating the same MHV amplitude in n equal 4 by a completely different method, which was MHV diagrams. And checked yesterday that the paper was 34 pages, and the paper we wrote on this other calculation is 17 pages. So it's at least half of the difficulty of the other calculation. So it can really be shown. So that's why I'm doing that. OK, so let's see. So first of all, the Wilson loop is gauge invariant, so I can pick any gauge I like. So let's pick the simplest one, Feynman gauge. And there, in that correlation function, I have to calculate this contraction, AB, which is just some propagator G mu nu AB of X minus, well, let's say 0 of X. So that's going to be delta AB in the Feynman big H is some eta mu nu. And then just by dimensional reasons, I can guess what has to sit here. And if I work in D dimensions, that's going to be D minus 2 over 2. So if I could work in 4 dimensions, that would be equal to 1. But we will see very soon that this contour is very special. Actually, people could have considered such contours much earlier, because it's a very nice contour. All the segments are well separated, and it's a function of these endpoints. So even for people interested in Wilson loops, this could have appeared earlier. Somehow it didn't. So we will see that because of the presence of these cusps, we cannot just work in 4 dimensions. We have to introduce some regularization. And for the Wilson loop, at the moment, at least, dimensional regularization is the way to go. And that's also the nice way to make contact with non-results in the literature, infrared divergences, and such things. OK, so that's going to be the propagator. So let me just get rid one and for all. So we have these two generators there, and the 1 over n factor. There is a trace of TATB, and there is a delta AB coming from the propagator, and that's going to give n squared minus 1 divided by 2n, which is also the Casimir of the fundamental. And together with g squared, in the large n limit, that's going to be g squared n. So that's proportional to lambda Toft. So we see one feature of the calculation, the one loop correction that we are addressing here is proportional to lambda Toft. OK, so now the remaining part of the calculation will be, now we have to, what we will have to do, we have to calculate we have to calculate the integral dx mu d1 nu of the remaining part of the propagator when it's stripped of the delta AB. And we have to sum over all possible contractions that we can make between different edges of the two contours. Okay, so basically we will take one edge from the first copy of the contour and connect it to one edge from the second copy of the contour and sum over possible contractions. Okay, so that's the calculation. And it's a very simple one. There are just three different types of connections that you can make. And they are all of them are very simple. So in the first class, you can pick the same segment in both copies of the contour and connect it with the propagator. Okay? So what is this calculation proportional to? So, well, on each, let's take a segment. This segment starts from xi and up, ends up in xi plus 1, and the momentum is pi, and it's the difference of these two points. So the coordinate along this segment is xi of sigma, which is just xi plus 1 minus xi times sigma, so that at sigma equals 0 we are here and sigma equals 1 we are there. And this is also xi minus pi sigma. And x dot I of sigma is just minus pi. So when I do this calculation, here I will have the integral over d sigma from the first copy, from 0 to 1, and then in d tau from the second copy, 0 to 1, and then there will be x dot of sigma dotted with y dot of tau, and it's dotted because g mu nu is proportional to eta mu nu, and then the well, if I call this function g of x, there's also some irrelevant coefficient in front, which it's not important for the calculation. This I'm not writing down. So we will just have g of x of sigma minus y of tau. And, well, we see that from the first class, from this first class, here we have just pi dot pi, and that's zero, because the segments are like-like. So from the first class of diagrams, there is no contribution whatsoever.
The denominator is zero as well.
Sorry?
But the denominator is zero as well. Oh, I see.
No, that's a non.
Epsilon is not zero. Okay.
We were taking V too seriously yesterday. Not everything that appears is zero.
I'm afraid that I don't have any nice identity like 1 over 1 equal to 1. But I will try. Let's see if we come up with some of them. Anyway, so now class number 2, there's another thing you can take. You can take a segment for the first copy and an adjacent segment from the second copy and connect them. These diagrams will be divergent, as we will see in a moment. That's why we have to stay in the dimensions. Okay, let's see what... Now let's write the denominator and see what happens to it. So again, let me call this point xi. This other point xi plus 1 and xi plus 2 here, so that this momentum is pi, this other momentum is pi plus 1. Well, we have to write the difference between x on the first segment and x on the, well, I call it y on the second segment. So we just have xi minus pi times sigma, that's from the first segment. And then we have minus xi plus 1 plus pi plus 1 tau. And xi minus xi plus 1 is pi, so this is just pi times 1 minus sigma plus pi plus 1 times tau. And when I square this, so when I do x of sigma minus y of tau, I square it because that's what I have here in the propagator. Well, there is only one term because pi and pi plus 1 are null, so I get 2 pi dot pi plus 1 times 1 minus sigma times tau, and that's also sii plus 1. It's the kinematic invariant form of the by the two momenta, 1 minus sigma times tau. And now we see why we need to regularize, because this integral, now if we look at this integral, that's going to be proportional to, we have d sigma from 0 to 1, integral from 0 to 1 in d tau, and the numerator there is pi dot pi plus 1. And in the denominator we have minus, and then we have si i plus 1 sigma well, 1 minus sigma, but I can also always change variables. So if I don't regularize, I get a log divergence from this integral, actually from both, and therefore I have to really write d minus 2 over 2. And let me write in a different color. D is going to be 4 minus 2 epsilon uv. So this is really a divergence which occurs when this propagator shrinks to zero size. When I approach the cusp, I generate a uv divergence from this calculation. That's going to be dual to the infrared divergences of the scattering amplitudes, as we will see in a moment. So I'm going to replace this d minus 2 over 2 by what it is in terms of epsilon, which is just 1 minus epsilon uv. And then this integral can be done instantaneously. Well, I'm not accustomed to having such big blackboards, so I tend to save space, but I won't. I can just erase this. So the result of this integral is just 1 over epsilon uv squared. That's the divergence. And then there is minus si I plus 1 to the minus 1 plus epsilon uv. And then we have one other power of si I plus 1 from this divided by 2. Now this result, we have one, that was for one cusp. Now we have to sum over all cusps. So we have already part of the result. So the contribution to the, well, let me summarize things here. So the contribution to the one loop Wilson loop only coming from cusp diagrams is equal to, well, there would be a sum over all cusps from 1 to n. There are n cusps in general. And then we have minus si I plus 1 to the plus epsilon uv divided by epsilon uv squared. And there is also a factor of minus 1 half in front. Now, if you know about scattering amplitudes, as everyone in this room does, well, you will recognize that this is precisely the expression for the infrared divergences of the scattering amplitudes at one loop, just divided by the three-level expression, which in any case we were not expecting to get. So there is already some nice result. There is a very special class of diagrams, which neatly gives rise to the complete infrared divergence structure of the scattering amplitudes at one loop. Okay, so now we have another class of diagrams to consider, and that will give rise to the finite parts. So this is one of the nice features of this one-loop calculation, that it very neatly disentangles infrared divergence from finite. Okay, so next and final explicit calculation is that of the finite class of diagrams. So now in this case, so that's the third class of diagrams, what we do, we connect two non-adjacent segments of the Wilson loop by a gluon propagator. Maybe I should also stress that the Wilson loop, which appeared as strong coupling, is just purely bosonic, and there are only gluons. So the only thing we can connect here are gluons. So if I do this calculation in n equal 1, 0, or 4, it's exactly the same. So, okay, let me call this momentum p, this momentum little q, and I will call xp and xp plus 1, and here xq and xq plus 1, these endpoints of these segments. And again, I want to just write x of y minus y of tau, same thing. That's going to be different now because the two segments don't meet. So it's just slightly more complicated. There will be some mass in the middle. So again, xp of sigma from the first segment is xp minus sigma times the momentum, as we saw before. And xq of tau is xq minus tau times q. And the difference between these two segments is xp of sigma minus xq of tau. That's equal to, well, xp minus xq, and then minus sigma p plus tau q. Now what is xp minus xq? Well, it's this momentum plus this momentum. So let me give a name to this. So this, you have to imagine that there are many edges of the Wilson loop. I don't care how many. let's just call big P, and here big Q, the sum of the momenta which appear there. So the calculation is going to be blind to how many there are, so that to the specific name of the momenta, just sum will appear. So this is going to be small p plus big P minus sigma P plus tau Q, which is the same as P times 1 minus sigma plus tau Q and plus big P. So now the difference is that big P here is not a null momentum. So when I square this, xp of sigma minus xq of tau, there will be big P squared from here, and then I have all the dot products between these two momenta and between this momenta and P. So I will have times 2 small p dot big P 1 minus sigma plus 2 times small q times big P times tau plus 2 pq 1 minus sigma times tau. Okay, so that's what's going to appear in our denominator. Now, this really looks like a four-point scattering somehow. So it's convenient to introduce variables s called p plus p squared, t, p plus q squared, or if you wish, q plus big P squared, and u, well, we can have s plus t plus u equal to p squared plus q squared. And we can try to re-express the result of our calculation in terms of these variables s and t. It's very simple. I won't do that. I'll just rewrite, for example, 2 small p dot big P. This is just big P plus small p squared minus big P squared, which is s minus p squared, and so on and so forth. Now, what is the integral we have to calculate now? That's another simple integral. And the simple integral we have to calculate now is, again, integral from 0 to 1 in d sigma, from 0 to 1 in d tau. The numerator has small little p dot little q, which comes from the dot product of the velocities. And the denominator, there is minus. I have to write the square, that's squared. So that square is going to be p squared plus this term is just s minus p squared, and it's multiplied by 1 minus sigma. And then there is this other term, and this is just t minus p squared. So that's t minus p squared multiplied by tau. And the last one is 2pq. That's the same as u. This is u, and that's the same as p squared plus q squared minus s minus t. So the last term over here is going to be plus p squared plus q squared minus s minus t. Okay? And now there is no infrared divergence in this integral. Nothing can produce infrared divergence, so I just delete the exponent in this bracket. If I wish, I can do it for, well, we did it also for epsilon non-zero, but somehow there is no point in doing that now. Okay, so what's the result of this integral? Well, this numerator, I can also write it as 1/2, and then there is p squared plus q squared minus s minus t.
Since the last term, a 1 minus sigma, missing?
Oh, yeah, probably I've lost. Yeah. I knew that there was something missing. So 1 minus sigma times tau. Thanks. Okay, so that's very simple. Mathematica can do it, especially if you have an older version of Mathematica. And the result is, I write one form which I like a lot. It's a combination of Li2s. A I will define in a moment what it is. It's a combination of four dialogues. minus. So there are two with positive signs, which have p squared and q squared, which are in general non-null in this calculation. And then there are s and t. And a is just little p dot q, and then p squared q squared minus st. And this function over here is one of the representations for a dear friend. That's a finite part of a two-Masisi box function. Now, the two-Masisi box function, so the massless legs are, of course, little p and little q. And the massive legs are all the remaining ones, so big P and big Q. So we can add the remaining part of the Wilson loop. Well, I can write the full result. Now, the full result is this, plus, I think there is a factor of 1/2, but don't trust me on numerical factors now. And then there is a sum over all possible P and Qs, because I have to sum over all possible contractions I can make of the finite part of these two Masisi box functions. And this is precisely the one-loop amplitude, the one-loop M3 amplitude in N equal 4, divided by the three-level M3 amplitude. So it is a simple calculation. It didn't take very, very long. And I believe this is the simplest way you can possibly derive this amplitude. I don't know of any other way which is simpler than this one. Now, what's surprising about this calculation? Well, many things. First of all, it comes from a completely different, the result comes from something which in principle we didn't know about strong coupling, wouldn't have anything to do with an amplitude. The only thing you could say is that we had Wilson lines, so perhaps you might expect that there might be some relation to the infrared divergent part of the amplitude. So the real surprise somehow is that the calculation produced also the finite parts. That's something totally unexpected from these kind of calculations. Okay, so the main point is the finite parts are correct. The other very nice feature, at least for us who like these things, is that infrared and finite pieces are very neatly disentangled in this calculation. So that's a nice feature. That's one of the beauties of this. And that's one of the things which, with methods we have currently, doesn't persist to higher loops. That's a real pity. Yeah.
But that only works in Feynman gauge, or how generic is that?
Well, that's right. If you change the gauge, you might even invent some crazy gauge where the cusp diagrams become zero,
right,
and everything gets. It's a gauge-dependent statement. But nevertheless, we like that Feynman gauge, so.
No, I know, but
that's the first. No, that's absolutely true.
If you go to higher loop, you get some modification of Feynman gauge.
We actually did. We did try at some point to use the crazy gauge, the one which removes the cusps, but it somehow became.
How can you remove the cusps?
It's a singular gauge, so.
But where does it come from then?
So that what was finite in this case becomes divergent and contains everything. It's a different gauge. It's not important.
Oops. Correct.
Sorry, no, I didn't hear. Okay.
How can that gauge produce? I mean, if it gets rid of the singularity, it must push.
But there is a one-way epsilon which appears in front of the propagators. Yeah, it's something very singular.
Oh, you mean that
not something you would try?
Stuff on the same. I mean, on
yeah, yeah. This non-adjacent contraction, they suddenly contain everything. You can invent that. It's. I think we ended up writing this gauge for completely different reasons because we were interested in gravity. But it's not important. But it's a very good point that this neat separation that I'm kind of praising and singing a song to is really gauge dependent. But okay, fine.
was there also some statement that, so there you took epsilon sort of infinitesimal, finite, but infinitesimal. If you kept epsilon finite and computed the answer to all orders, even for the finite graph,
yes,
does that agree with the amplitude computed?
So for the 4-point case, it agrees to the amplitude to all orders in epsilon. So it reproduces the result from string theory of Green, Schwartz, and Brink. If you go beyond 4-point, it only reproduces part of it. There are also pentagons which will be vanishing in epsilon in the complete result, and this result only produces boxes, except it will produce the expression of the boxes to all orders in epsilon, which comes out very nearly. So, but only at 4-point, that's the full result.
So somehow the statement is that you can't compute amplitudes in n equals 4 supremas in 4 dimensions, but if you compute them in 4 minus 2 epsilon with epsilon negative dimensions, that's not dual.
Well, there is something quite funny that with Mark we found some time ago with Mark and the other friends. So, okay, the next part now is discussing the two-loop calculation. So, what we looked at, first of all, we look at the four-point the four-point Wilson loop at two loops, and we tried also to keep a higher order in epsilon. And also we looked at a definite part of the five-point amplitude, namely the parity even part. Because this pentagon I was referring to is parity odd. So if you restrict to that, and we could do one more order in epsilon, it's very hard to go beyond the order one for the two-loop Wilson loop, because the integrals are very hard, as I will show you in a moment. That's why they are on the wiki page. And we found some completely surprising agreement. I think it's an agreement which cannot be called a coincidence. And it's still unexplained. I think one day one will want to really understand what is the deep reason for this agreement between amplitudes and Wilson loops. And it looks like it might even go slightly away from four dimensions. But let me just not say too much on this because one of the things we said, we are collecting data. So that's one element which can be given to the story. More questions? Loops? Well, I'm not going very well with time, but we are going. We don't care, so we are training for the afternoon talk of the NIMA. No, there is lunch, so I won't. Okay, two loops, much more difficult. So let me show some members of the cast of characters. But now, unfortunately, Juan Maldacen and friends, now they have different methods to calculate this this quantity at weak coupling. So far, we only resorted to what we know, so Feynman diagrams. So we have some of the bad features of Feynman diagrams, meaning that like quite important cancellation between different contributions. But okay, that's still. Let me just, since there are people interested in integrals, let me just write down some formal expression of integrals. So we have different, first of all, we have the cusps. All the cusps are two loops, they are all under control. So that's no problem coming from there. So let me write down some of these integrals. Now there's one thing which I can say. Now you see here there is a self-energy. That's a single point where the theory really enters. Here there will be running of different species. So here we know that we are talking about n equal 4. That's a single diagram where this happens. And it's also quite interesting that the combination of these two diagrams is transcendental. And if you just change this a little bit, the result will become slightly non-transcendental. So I generate. But the only source of non-transcendentality comes from that diagram. And they all, non-analytically, is very simple too. It takes very, very little time. If you start from there, you may think that you can do everything analytically very quickly, but fortunately it's not true. Then there are more complicated diagrams.
Sorry, the last diagram you've got, the blue on lines cross?
Yeah, well, okay, I should say something more, but yeah, so it's not a four-point vertex. There are two propagators which cross. So for Hagen loops, I can just say something before, before continuing on there. Well, there is something, we know that the Wilson loop can be put into this form. Well, that would be a triviality, except that we know exactly how to calculate the exponent. So we know a rule, which is called maximally non-abelian exponentiation theorem, which tells you which kind of diagrams you have to pick in order to just calculate the exponent. Now, I can say that in words so that I don't spend too much time. So basically, if you were working in an abelian theory, you would basically exponentiate the one loop result. So here there will be the one loop result exponentiated and nothing else. So what the theorem tells you is what is the failure to the exponentiation of the one loop result. And the failure comes because here at these endpoints there are color indices associated to and different color structures. So the theorem tells you, okay, you have trace, well, I can just write two. The two color structure which I have here, I have A, B, B, A. So here there is a trace of T, A, T, B, T, B, T, A. Whereas here there is A, B, and this is again A, and this is B. So there is T, A, T, B, T, A, T, B. So if these two traces were the same, then I could exponentiate one. They are not, and therefore there is a little failure. And the theorem tells us exactly how to address that. It turns out that in order to follow this theorem, it's enough to calculate only the cross case. The non-cross exponentiates trivially. Okay, so that's why I'm omitting certain diagrams. That's the reason. And it's nice also because the strong coupling result, the BDS conjecture, they all are in a form of an exponential, so this immediately makes contact with that. Now let's start writing down more complicated integrals. So for example, some other integrals are obtained by performing these contractions. And now these edges now are no longer adjacent. And this always goes hands in hands with this one. This is a thing called the Y diagrams. Or we can call it, we can call it four or something. And then there are other diagrams where you take three edges and start contracting them with propagators like this. This we call the curtain. I've got household names. So that's the curtain diagrams. Then there are some other diagrams where you connect two non-adjacent with propagators like this. I think this we call the cross. And then there are other diagrams which connect four different edges. That's completely trivial. That's a square of two. Well, this is a one loop, this is a one loop result, so that's completely trivial. But you already see there's something which really want to be cancelled by something else. That guy is going to be cancelled partly by something else. And finally, there is a stumbling block of the calculation, which is the integral in the wiki page, which I think we call it the hard integral for obvious reason. And that's an integral where you have a three-point gluon vertex attached to three non-adjacent edges. So these momenta are all null, little p, little q, and little r. And in between there are sums of momenta. They can also be zero, they can be one, so in that case they are null, but in general they are not null. So in the most generic case, when big p squared, big q squared, big r squared, when they are all non-zero, then this integral is finite. Still, it's very hard. And there was this very intense calculation by Del Duca, Dura, and Smirnov, where they evaluated explicitly all the integrals using some quasi-multi-reg limit. This one is the one which produced most of the 17 pages. And then Mark and Anastasia and Christian, they were able to reduce that to basically one line. But maybe one thing I should say is that in your approach, you somehow needed to have the explicit expression of this object. So there is still a point in calculating these integrals explicitly. Apart from a curiosity, if you want to get 7 points at the moment, Juan and friends will probably get it before. But one way is to evaluate these integrals and then feed them to people who know how to, well, we know motive technology and can contract them to something smaller. Plus, well, we spend so much time on these things. I would love to see the analytic expression of this guy. And I'm sure my friends do. Okay, I just want to write down what is the form of the result we expect, because I want to point out some subtleties which appear there. And well, then I will try to converge towards some conclusion and then pass to Sven. What do we expect to find? Again, let me talk about just two loops. So we like harmony, we like logs, as Andrew pointed out the other day. So we like to write down the log of the, okay, we divide, take the amplitude and divide it by the 3-level amplitude. And we will, compare this to our Wilson loop calculation. So what we want to do, we want to really write the expansion of the log of 1 plus, well, if I call this m, and it would be an expansion a m1 plus a squared m2 plus dot dot dot, and a similar expansion for the Wilson loop. And we want to write the second order term of the logs, okay, because they are naturally in an exponential form, we think. So for the amplitude, that will be m2 minus 1 half m1 squared. And for the Wilson loop, that will be w2 minus 1 half w1 squared. So the BDS conjecture, which tells us this, that this should be proportional to m1 of 2 epsilon. So that's a one loop amplitude shifted to 2 epsilon, just for dimensional reasons, if you wish, multiplied by this beautiful function f2 of epsilon, which I will write in a moment, plus some two-loop constant, plus now the remainder function up to loops. Now we know there is a remainder function. Now this function over here has got three terms. The first term is related to the Kaspar anomalous dimension. The second term is the, well, it's called collinear anomalous dimension. And the last one, I think, it's got no name, it's not really no name. Now, why am I writing this? Because there will be a slight subtlety here. There will be actually a slightly different function for the Wilson loop. And here we will have W1 of 2 epsilon. Well, then will be a slightly different constant. That's not very important. But I guess the important point is that, in writing in red, the remainder function in the two calculations is claimed to be the same. What I want to stress is that here there is a difference. The difference occurs in this coefficient over here. This coefficient at two loops from the amplitude is zeta 2, or minus zeta 2, and for the Wilson loop is plus 7, that's zeta 3, and this has a factor of 7. They're really different. So I think it's important, if you have a calculation, well, even if you want to map to amplitudes, you have to keep in mind that this part of the calculation is slightly different. You really have to define the duality for finite parts. So if you have also specific extension for the Wilson loops, maybe that should also incorporate such a different, slightly different feature of the alternate. I think I would love to hear more about this from the people who have worked on that, maybe when they're free next week or something. Because there are some, well, there is some little controversy, probably, it's fair to say, on the supersymmetrization of the Wilson loops, or at least Gregory would say that there is some controversy. Some controversy.
Why?
Yes.
If you change your n equals 4 theory to dimensionally regularized n equals 4, or you change it in some other way to...
I am dimensionally regularized n equals 4. I am dimensionally regularized.
Exactly. Yeah. So why? And then you do this T-duality. Why do you expect that comes out as dimensionally regularized n equals 4 on the other side? Is there any reason to expect that?
Oh, well, in principle, the I guess the answer is we don't know.
I mean, it seems to me that you're just providing evidence that it doesn't quite.
I can tell you what people tried. So you have two different calculations, and you say, well, they're different, so let's try to match them as we can. So even epsilon, the two calculations, no right to be the same.
Right.
So you can try to map them in many ways. You always hit a problem, which whatever redefinition you're trying to make, you're going to spoil the agreement of the finite parts. You're going to do something, because here, what we are changing here, maybe I should say that more clearly, is the 1 over epsilon pole. The 1 over epsilon squared poles are exactly the same, but these are not. If you try to make this agree, no way. You will change the finite parts.
What do you mean try to make it agree? What do you mean?
Well, you want to
replace an epsilon by a function.
Replace epsilon by a function. But not only that, also you can, well, there will be a divergence which is of the form minus s over mu squared. And you say, well, mu squared is not the same in the two calculations. So try to match them. People tried everything. It doesn't work.
Again, is that still saying that working with a dimensionally regularized theory on both sides? It's just that you assume epsilon on one side goes to some complicated function of epsilon on the other side.
He's saying that doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
I can propose a simple formula.
But those are all the things that you tried, right? All the things you tried to make it work were of that type.
Well, there are two things you can think of trying, I believe. And one is mu squared, the other one is epsilon. If you can think of something else, just...
No, but you're still using the same regularization scheme, if you like, but just with a very different notion of epsilon on the two sides. No simple relation.
They're pretty different.
And you're just saying that doesn't work.
Well, one is UV and the other one's IR.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's not even dim reg, is what
you're
saying.
But I would interpret this as... the important point here is that the symmetries are forcing these functions to be the same, and then some numbers come out different. And then the symmetry didn't force the numbers to be the same. So, okay, but the important thing is the symmetries are the same. That's what we're learning from here.
I should also stress that we have a lot of evidence, and Svi and friends collected a lot of, and Mark and Anastasia, from the six-point calculation, but we are still stuck there. So maybe we have surprises beyond. We don't think there will be surprises, but...
Somebody's saying is there is no p-duality of variant regularization.
Suppose we started on the amplitude side and we'd use the mass regularization, which some people use.
Yeah.
That certainly would not correspond. Nobody would think that corresponds to a mass regularization on the Wilson side for any value or any function of what the mass was in terms of... It will be a regularized theory, but it will be a different regularization scheme. Okay.
But so at the end of the day, the R function is...
The R function.
Yeah, maybe I want to say that. We should really swap the logic. The really important fact, maybe let me stress the important fact. The R function is the same. That's a really important thing.
But what I'm saying,
I'm just trying to say that...
It's not necessarily a failure of some in-principle duality between Wilson loops on one side and amplitudes on the other. It's just that the regularization scheme, you also have to understand how that goes through. And it doesn't necessarily go to the same...
Our function being the same is a choice, because, as I said, you could change.
But it's extremely non-trivial.
No, let me.
It's not a choice.
It's extremely non-trivial.
Let me say no. One very important thing is that the R function, we know property of the R function. It's a function of these dual conformal cross ratios. Now, if I do these modifications into mu and epsilon, that's no longer to be the case. So that's very important. Now, I'm really running over time, so I was trying to talk about...
Which version of dimensional regularization are you using?
Oh, well, that's very subtle. Dimensional reduction, we should be saying. I think that's...
Really dimensional reduction.
For this calculation, it's not really important because there are more polarizations. If you have an amplitude calculation, that maybe becomes a little more important. It seems that some of the subtleties that Korchemsky and Belitsky and Sokachev found in the supersymmetric space-time Wilson loops precisely arise from the regularization, from the fact that the polarization are stuck in four dimensions, whereas the momenta are in d dimensions. So that's the point where...
There's whole issues of evanescent couplings and so on, and all that's going to affect the simple poles. At the two loop level, right?
Well, in that calculation. Sorry?
It's just the ambiguities we're talking about.
What is it?
Okay. I mean, the scheme is ambiguous. Any regularization scheme, there's some ambiguity.
But you want it to be unitary, right?
Yeah, but it's still a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
Actually, one more comment about the R function is that there's an important constraint on it, which is that it vanishes in all the collinear limits. And then you can't play play games with it. So there is a way of uniquely picking out what you mean by the R function.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about the dual conformal symmetry and the corresponding anomaly. This I will skip because otherwise. So I just take 5 more minutes. I just introduce some functions, and then Sven will discuss this much more in depth with you. Now, why form factors? Well, for many reasons. Because they are important for, they appear in important calculations. For example, when you look at, if you look at E plus E minus going to hadrons, what you have In part of the calculation, you will have a matrix element between the vacuum and some hadronic state x of the hadronic electromagnetic current. So that's one example of form factor. Second reason is the simplicity. Well, simplicity means unexpected simplicity. So again, we actually learned from some quite funny thing written by Predrag Cvetanović. I told the story already to some of you guys. Cvetanović was calculating the three-loop correction to the G minus 2 of the electron together with Kinoshita. And then one day he gave a seminar. Well, he had to give a seminar in front of Feynman. And he started, he was very scared about the fact that this result ended up to be like of order 1 and not of the order of the number of diagrams or some other number. And he thought that Feynman might ask, why is it order 1 and not the number of diagrams? So he looked more in detail at the calculation, and he found cancellations, precisely the things that we see when we use Feynman diagrams for amplitudes. And then he invented something. He was able to somehow repackage the calculation into gauge invariant pieces. And then he saw that within each gauge invariant subset, the result was more or less the same. So that's kind of things that we like. So anyway, he was pointing out to the unexpected simplicity and our lack of understanding of this simplicity, and maybe, I don't know, maybe that's why he turned to a different subject. I don't know. That's one reason. And I guess the other important reason is that it's kind of interesting to try to go off shell in a sort of controlled way. So again, as I said, what we do, we take, so our definition of a form factor, we take some local operator, local gauge invariant operator in our theory, and we form such combinations. And we can also, if we wish, so we can Fourier transform this object with e to the iqx, and the result is 2 pi to the fourth, and there is a delta 4 of q minus the sum of our momenta pi, and multiplied by and now the momentum q squared will in general be non-zero. So what we may want to calculate is directly this this quantity. Now in n equal 4, there are special classes of operators that you may want to consider first, for example, they are half BPS operators. So you take scalar fields, phi AB, and A and B go from 1 to 4, so SU4 indices, and take special operators called ABCD, which are the trace of phi AB, phi CD, minus 1/12 of the trace of phi MN, phi bar MN. And the simplest one is 0,1212, which is just a trace of phi 1,2 squared. Now these operators are half BPS. That's they are protected, so their anomalous dimensions are just the canonical anomalous dimension. There are no corrections to that. So you may expect, for one thing, a calculation which is free of ultraviolet divergences. So in the remaining 1 minute, I will just show you some example of simplicity, which at least for us was slightly unexpected. So you can take, for example, trace of 512 squared of zero, and well, you certainly need two scalars. So I can take phi in some position I, phi 1, 2, and phi in position j, but I can also add many good ones. But I must say, one motivation why we decided to consider these objects with not only the two scalars, which would correspond to the Sudakov form factor that Sven will discuss about, was another paper by Maldasen and Zhiboedov, very nice paper where they addressed the calculation of form factors at strong coupling. And in order to understand, well, to have some more insight on this structure, we just decided to have more than two legs, just to have more kinematic invariance in order to study the results in more detail. And I won't discuss about that, but their result, a strong coupling, had periodic Wilson loop featuring as an important character. So one question is not completely understood, is whether we can map this to a corresponding periodic Wilson loop at weak coupling and obtain form factors also from Wilson contours in some way. But anyway, that's why we started considering these objects. And they are so kind of interesting already at tree level. So if you consider this at tree level, you find an expression which is very familiar. It's almost Park-Taylor, except that the numerator is slightly different. It's ij squared. So that's tree level. And here there is a delta of q minus the sum of the momenta. It's a holomorphic function, and therefore we immediately know that this object will be localized on a line in twisted space if you want to understand that. And once you have this insight, you can try MHV diagrams, which come precisely from the correspondence between, well, lines in twisted space and points in Minkowski space, and that also works. So you can take the traditional, well, it's not very old, so the standard MHV diagrams for the gauge theory, and add some extra vertices which have the form, some MHV form factors, precisely these guys, and start constructing non-MHV form factors, and that works also. It's not published, but one day we will publish it. And you can do other things like BCFW recursion relations. That also seems to work. And let me write down one loop result, which is also very simple. I don't even need to write. So that object, let me call this that F. So F at one loop is also very simple. It's just a sum of infrared divergent pieces. Again, don't trust me on the coefficients. Plus, very similar form to that, sum over P, well, let's call it P prime now, of finite part of two Massisi box functions with legs P and P prime. The only difference compared to the amplitude calculation is that here we have many legs, and inside these bunches, there will also be Q. Now, Q is the momentum carried by this operator. The operator is a color singlet, so the important difference compared to this color-ordered calculation is that Q can sit in different positions. He can sit wherever he wants. It doesn't spoil the color ordering. So it's a slightly non-planar calculation, although we have still kept the planar ordering of the particles in the external state. Okay, and then one can go beyond and try to calculate two loops and check exponentiation, and there are many interesting things to do, and well, I think that's probably a good point to stop and pass to Sven.
Yes? Yes, has only half the supersymmetry?
Sorry?
It only has half the supersymmetry?
This operator, that's only half BBS,
yes,
this operator.
So I'll just make a comment that that's actually n equals 2 MHV tree.
That's an n equals 2 MHV tree?
That's the proportion factor for n equals 2
MHV. Oh, I see, okay.
So that's, which is...
That's, you say that's why there is a square power of 2.
Yeah, exactly.
should get undressed with this thing.
Pass the baton or perform a duality transition?
Yeah, let's go to duality, but I don't see this.
Okay.
Can we switch the one? Okay, so I have a little bit of data which we can look at before we start. I'll switch gear completely. And I should also clean a bit the board. So I have some QCD data which we should look at just to get an impression of what we're dealing with. And the data is basically concerned with the massless form factor in QCD. Like this? Okay. So this is basically, say you take a photon going to QQ bar, then you take the same expression when you have a massive form factor. This is like a photon going to a massive quark pair. Then we have amplitudes. Amplitudes or squared amplitudes I'll be showing actually for scattering of QQ bar going to Q prime, and likewise QQ going to QQ bar. And all this at higher orders, current state of the art. And then we can just try to see during the talk what it needs to understand those quantities. So this is the first thing. This is the quark form factor at higher orders. This is one loop, two loop, three loop. This is just at three loop up to the order 1 over epsilon. So last year, Wyckoff, Steinhauser, and Chiturkin calculated the finite parts here, so that adds a couple more lines. And then Gehrmann and Glover calculated the order epsilon parts. That fills about the page up to here. And as you can see, the structure is beautifully transparent. I'll detail that to you. If you add quark masses, then this is the result that had been calculated in 2004 by those people here, Bernreuther and collaborators. This is now the expression that you get when you keep the heavy quark mass. And just to give you an idea of how it looks like, so you have 1 over epsilon. This is the one loop thing. We normalized, you have 1 over epsilon divergences. And then you have these harmonic polylogs, and X is a combination of the invariant mass and the heavy quark mass. Then you have some finite things, and you see logs of the heavy quark mass. So it doesn't look really nice, and this is also what the authors found when they published the paper. They said it doesn't really look very nice, but we can try to understand whether in certain limits it becomes a bit easier. And then if you go to four-point functions, this is data from 2000, so it's more than 10 years old, but that's actually the status that we have in QCD. This is for the squared amplitude of scattering of quarks into distinct, a pair of quarks with distinct flavor. This is the whole finite part of the squared amplitude. Divergences had been subtracted. Later, Zvi Bern and de Freitas calculated also the amplitude, and Nigel Glover did the same. And we can already see here why QCD goes a bit beyond n equal 4, because this coefficient here is what would be leading color in the planar limit.
but you have a few more pages, so this is also what we need to deal with. And when you have gluons in the initial state and then you produce a Q-loop out here, it again becomes a bit more messy depending on the channels that you're looking at. Okay, so this is the data, and we can try to see what we can do with it. So okay, so so duality was the dual view was the point suggested by Zvi, but I'd rather like to take the title beyond BDS or subtitle. And the first thing, if we start off from the viewpoint that we start in N equal 4 super young nils, then what additional things come in when you go to QCD? Well, the first thing is there is no conformal invariance anymore. The second thing is, of course, you have subleading color. And the third thing is, especially quarks are massive. And these things I'd like to talk about from the viewpoint of the infrared structure. So with respect to conformal invariance, as far as the infrared singularities are concerned, this can be easily solved because we take the beta function of QCD and we consider it in dimensional regularization. So we take d equal 4 minus 2 epsilon, and that means we can also write down a running coupling in d dimensions, and the running coupling in d dimensions denote by a bar. It depends on the scale lambda. And of course, on the dimensionality that you shift away from space-time, and a beta function is then mu d d mu. The four-dimensional beta, the d-dimensional beta function depends on the d-dimensional running coupling. This is then the d-dimensional beta function, depending on the running coupling, and this can be expanded in terms of the normal four-dimensional beta function, and because of the shift in dimensionality, you get running already at tree level. So there is a small running already at tree level of the d-dimensional coupling, and then you have the normal four-dimensional beta function, which you can expand in terms of the four-dimensional running coupling. And the solution to this, the one loop, is given here. So you have, in terms of the four-dimensional running coupling, which I'll denote by alpha s, at the scale lambda, you can compute the d-dimensional running coupling as mu squared over lambda squared to the power epsilon minus 1 over epsilon 1 minus mu squared over lambda squared to the power epsilon beta naught, and then alpha s of lambda over 4 pi to the power minus 1. And if you expand it again in epsilon, then you see that generates you all the logarithmic running of the four-dimensional beta function. And the nice thing is that with this expression, all the soft and collinear divergences that we'll be encountering can simply be generated by an integral over the running coupling. So that makes it a very powerful technical tool. And all the expressions that all the integrals that I'll be writing down will depend on the d-dimensional running coupling. And whenever you need to compute something explicitly, then this is what you have to keep in mind. Okay, so then the next thing is to address the issue of color flow. For for an n parton multicolored amplitude, so we denote this by m of n, and this can be any 2 to n parton scattering with colored external legs. And in the infrared, the picture that we have is a factorization which separates various momentum regions. Of regions with, say, different momentum dependence. And this factorization is actually the key. Understanding this and being able to write down such a factorization is the key then to, first of all, understanding the infrared structure, and also then to writing down something that exponentiates to higher orders. And the picture that you often find people writing down is that you have some hard part of your amplitude m of n, and then the external partons that are going into this hard part are denoted by something like a jet function. So we call this j here. And there can be more, but 4 is enough, I guess, to illustrate it. And then, of course, there is, since this is all colored external particles, there is also a soft function in the game. So the jet functions, they are, as the word says, they're supposed to summarize all the momentum dependence of fast-moving partons near the light cone. Your hard function is something you can think of as the Born scattering amplitude, some tree-level amplitude. And then there is, of course, soft gluon exchange everywhere. So there must be some additional piece which accounts for this. And this soft function connects to all these external partons through soft gluon exchange. So this is the sketchy picture which we can write on. And in order to put that into a formula, we can start off with our amplitude in a given color representation. So that is maybe what I should also briefly sketch to you, if it's not clear otherwise. So suppose we have QQ bar scattering here with color representations in the fundamental, with color in the fundamental representation I, J, K, and L. Then we can decompose that in an amplitude A1, with the color being connected J and K and I and L, plus an amplitude M2 with the color being connected in this way, S channel I, J, L, and K. And so these elements basically form the basis of a vector, and I'll denote them by M index, say L. And this way we can enumerate the whole color basis. And now we have our amplitude for fixed angles. So we keep the relative angles between all those partons fixed. They depend on the momenta. They depend on alpha s of mu, of course. And they depend on epsilon. And then this factorization introduces the soft function, which is a matrix in the in color space, and this only depends on the relative velocity, so beta are the rescaled momenta of the individual partons, beta I and beta j, then of course also an alpha s of mu and of epsilon. Then we have our Hart function, which describes all the effects of the Hart partons, which depends on momenta dot products pi pj, normalized by mu squared. And then, of course, the Hart function needs to know about the relative directions of the partons, which we fix by an external directional dependent vector n. So n fixes directions of the jets.
Sam, for those of us who are getting older, can you write a little bigger?
Oh, sure, sure. Okay, so h depends on basically on all the Hart momenta and on the relative angle of those Hart momenta with respect to the jets, and then alpha s of mu, and well, there is no dependence on epsilon anymore. Then of course we have to attach the external jets, and this is then the product over all the external particles. We have a jet function depending on the external particles from I running from 1 to n. And they, as I said, depend on the direction normalized by n i squared. So n, this is something like an axial gauge, you can think of it. And alpha s of mu and epsilon. And then we normalize them by some function we call script j, which depends on the relative velocity. This is it. So this is the master formula for the factorization of those amplitudes, and we can make sense out of it if we can come up with proper definitions of all those functions. And this is pretty straightforward, actually, because if we think of such an amplitude here, if we try to motivate such a formula from low multiplicities, then if we start off with a form factor, then we would be having such a thing. Here we would be having two jets here, and we would be having a soft function in between. But since there would be, that would basically be a singlet in color space, we can, there is a certain ambiguity between what we put in a soft function and in the jet function. And from this we can deduce that the jet function j is basically the square root of the, all the quantum corrections to the form factor. So keeping this in mind, we have already solved, or with that definition, we have already solved for the jet function. And I'll come back and we can discuss the form factor a little bit later in more detail. The interesting thing is now to look at the soft function here and at this normalized jet function, because there we can learn something. Because those can be, so S and this script function J, they are Eichner functions defined from Wilson lines as operators. So you can motivate such a definition by taking again the complete amplitude and then looking at How do you have to, what kind of assumptions do you need to make about the participating momenta in the game in order to come up with a set of effective Feynman rules? So the jet function script J is basically, I skip the indices here, the architecture is basically two Wilson lines starting in infinity, meeting at an angle, and moving again out to infinity. And the S function is a bit more complicated. It's basically a web of operators, of Wilson lines, so with the indices L and K in a given color representation. So here I can write the arguments, so that depends on beta A dot beta B on alpha S of mu and on epsilon. And that is, say, for instance, for four quarks, would have a tensor here, all the irreducible representations, which we can use to express four quark charges. Then we could write this as the sum over I prime, J prime, K prime, and L prime. And now again, coupling four Wilson lines to each other with indices K and K prime, and momenta depending on if you have, it's basically such an object here. So you have P1 or beta 1, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, beta 4 as external velocities and color charges I, J, K, and L. And then you have four Wilson lines all starting off at infinity moving into one point. And I and I prime, depending on beta 1, and the next Wilson line, beta 3, J, J prime, and the final one, depending on beta 4, minus beta 4 if it runs out from infinity to zero, sandwiched between the vacuum and color states L and L prime. And then we have to sum over all the possible representations I, J, K prime, and L prime. So this way it is a match. And if you just take this example of four external quarks, then this would be the basic operator. This is the operator here for the jet function. This is something like this here in terms of Wilson lines. And once we have defined the operators, we can, so from the operators, we can compute the quantum corrections. And all the singularities show up as UV divergences. It means in this effective operator definition, all the inferred singularities that we are interested in, taking an amplitude apart, are transformed into the ultraviolet divergences of these operators, and we need to study their renormalization group properties. And for the soft function, yeah, basically, is it clear how to come from, say, a complete Feynman diagram amplitude to such effective Feynman rules? Maybe I sketch it briefly, because if we have suppose you have something like this here. You have a quark which emits a gluon. The gluon has momentum k. Quark has momentum p here. Then the expression, if this is on shell, then the expression you would write down is a U of P, and then here for the vertex you have I times the strong coupling constant times color charge times gamma mu. So if this has an index mu, then you have I times P slash minus plus K slash plus M in the numerator, and you have P minus P plus Q squared minus M squared plus some I epsilon in the denominator. And now this is the expression you would have in the complete amplitude, and if you're interested in a soft limit, then you let the momentum K of the gluon become smaller than all the other momenta regions, and that means you can discard it in the denominator, and you can discard in the numerator, you can discard the quadratic term here in the denominator, and what you end up with is basically an expression quark spinner times GS times TA times P mu over P dot K plus I epsilon, and this is the effective Feynman rules of Wilson lines. So this is how you can see it in any diagram, and you can, of course it's much easier if you have these effective rules, then you can simply assemble it, but this way you arrive here at this this operator notation. Now, in order to constrain this or understand the structure of the scattering amplitude, and in particular in order to solve for the structure of the soft function, we need to look at this object here. And since it is multiplicatively renormalized under since it renormalizes multiplicatively, if we consider the quantum corrections, we can write down an evolution equation, multiplicative renormalization. Okay, that gives us mu dv mu of s, depending on the arguments, equals, and here I should write S, this is I and K, this minus S I J of the arguments times an anomalous dimension, which gets the index S for soft, and since these are all matrices, you have to think of it as matrix multiplication, and it depends, of course, on the relative velocities of the Wilson lines of the dot product. So dot product beta I beta j depends on alpha s. You can compute it to higher orders in epsilon and so on and so forth. And you can, if you solve this, since it's matrix multiplication, you solve it as a path ordered exponential. A solution for s is then basically p x of minus 1/2 integral from 0 to infinity d lambda squared over lambda squared, and here you have gamma s of beta I beta j dot product, and here you have a lambda squared epsilon and epsilon. So if you solve it, then it pays off here to use the d-dimensional running coupling, because that'll generate then all the soft divergences. So the main question is, do we know this object here, and what do we know about the form of this object based on the factorization that we have written down? So people sat down to calculate it, first to one loop order, and then to two loop order. And the surprising thing that was found was that gamma s as an expansion as say alpha s over pi, gamma 1 plus alpha s squared over pi gamma 2, yeah, plus the higher orders. And when this was calculated, it was done first by Matt Ibert, Dixon, and Sturman, and independently by Penin, Smirnov, and Greenland collaborators for quark for fermion scattering, they found that it is given as 1/2 k times gamma 1. And k is the well-known factor 67 over 12 minus zeta 2 times ca minus 5 over 9 nf. And so everybody who's done calculations like this in QCD knows this is basically the second order coefficient of the cusp anomalous dimension. And the remarkable thing here is if you have this expansion, then it is totally clear that there is no new color information and no new momentum information going in at higher orders into this object here. And so that calls for a deeper understanding. And so the understanding of gamma s that comes from looking at the factorization constraints and that is work that has been done by Gardi and Manier and independently by Becher and Neubert about 1.5 years ago and they looked at this formula here. They started off with this formula and they said, wait a minute, we have this nice structure and we have this separation with a soft anomalous dimension. And we have taken out the form factor here in all our amplitudes. So what we are left with, or the jet function if you wish, which is the square root of the form factor, so all we are left with in our amplitude is a soft function divided or normalized accordingly by this Eichner jet function. And so we defined a so-called reduced soft function S bar, which is basically the S function, the original one, divided by all the products of these Eichner jet functions. Now the nice thing is the following. This function, this reduced soft function, this cannot depend on the cusp anomalous dimension anymore, because the cusp anomalous dimension, this is entirely, if you make any rescalings of this velocity beta, then this goes entirely in the cusp anomalous dimension here. So this is taken care of here. So the reduced function is independent of any dependence of the cusp anomalous dimension, which you can see if you differentiate it with respect to its argument, beta I times ni normalized by nj. That means this reduced function can only depend on certain ratios. They call them rho ij. When you have n I squared times n j squared times beta I dot beta j squared normalized by beta I dot n I squared and beta j dot n j squared. So the soft function can only depend on those quantities any. And all that, and for the diagonal part, if you put that into, if you look at the renormalization group equation, then for the diagonal part, all the dependence on the cusp anomalous dimension between S and J has to cancel. And that led them to strong constraints. And in particular, it gave them, in view of the time, I'll skip the intermediate part of the derivation, but it led them to write down an evolution equation in this variable rho, where the sum over all external legs d log rho ij 40 anomalous dimension, so maybe I should I guess it's clear. You take mu dd mu on this object here, mu dd mu on this object here, so you get, so that produces you the reduced soft anomalous dimension, and that can be expressed in the original soft anomalous dimension minus, if this is in color space I and j, minus for the diagonal part, the sum over all the cusp anomalous dimensions, and with the respective dependence on the momenta, you can turn that into an evolution equation for these ratios rho, so that you can write down for the reduced anomalous dimension in color space as a function of rho and alpha s, an equation which relates it to 1/4 of the cusp anomalous dimension. As a function of alpha s. This is then diagonal in color space, and this has to hold for all external partons I. This is a pretty strong constraint because it tells you that the soft emission, which you need to add on top of your jet functions and the hard emissions, is pretty well constrained, and it's directly related to the cusp anomalous dimension. And solving this evolution equation, log of rho ij, that means if you solve it, there is a very simple dependence on the kinematics, and this is entirely logarithmic. So we can put it over here. So then there is a minimal solution. This is called the dipole formula. Because it basically involves only two adjacent colored dipoles. So this index dip. Is given by minus 1 over 8 times the cusp anomalous dimension. Times the sum over all j not equal to I. Then the log of these ratios rho ij. And then we can introduce color operators. Ti dot tj. Plus, and here we have 1/2 times the anomalous dimension of the diagonal jet function times the sum over all color operators ti dot ti. So since we're working in a matrix notation, then it's advantageous to introduce operators which are either ta in the fundamental representation or fabc in the adjoint representation. And since we wanted to take advantage of this observation here, then the objects which are appearing here, they actually take into account, if this is a formula which is supposed to hold both for quarks and gluons, then this is to take into account the quadratic Casimir scaling of the cusp anomalous dimension. That means we divide these objects just by the Casimir, so Ci by the quadratic Casimir, which is either Ci or Cf, depending on whether you have quarks and gluons, and this is about it. And this has been checked to two-loop order. It can be used as a predictive tool to three-loop orders. Its derivation, because in solving this here, you rely on pretty much on the color structure that is observed so far in the cusp anomalous dimension. Its derivation relies on the quadratic Casimir scaling of gamma cusp. And this has been observed to three loop order, so this is verified to that order. However, beyond that, you can write down, this is one of the open problems. So open problem is for loop gamma cusp in QCD, because in principle, you can write down at for loop order a color factor which goes as dABCD times dABCD. Such an object appears in the for loop beta function, so it's not excluded that we get something at higher orders, and this would certainly violate this quadratic Casimir scaling and would force you to have more refined solutions than at the for loop order, which replace those logarithms then by functions of conformal cross ratios of more than two partite invariants, pretty much as we see it also in on the Enickel 4 side, if we go to higher point functions at the 2 and 3 loop order. So this is, I think, a very nice result about the soft anomalous dimension. So we have all the ingredients to really use this factorization in a constructive way. What is still missing now is the form factor here. And also that exponentiates. I mean, this has been known already for quite a long time. And the interesting thing here in QCD is its basically its structure. So, 5 more minutes. Is that okay? Yeah. Then I guess lunch has the unitarity bound, so can try to be quick. So the idea for the form factor is the following. You have, suppose you're looking at that function here, and if it's massless quarks, it's basically u of k1 gamma mu u of k2, and then there is a function f, which depends on the large momentum which goes in here. So q squared over mu squared can be computed in powers of alpha s. And of course, it's an infrared diversion quantity. Now, the factorization that you are exploiting in order to organize the infrared structure is you take the log of the form factor and you separate all the dependence on the large momentum scale. You separate this into a finite function. So you look at the scale derivative with respect to the large momentum scale of your form factor, and you separate this into a function k of alpha s, mu, and epsilon. So this is a pure counter term plus a function g, which contains all the large scale dependence. And of course, so this ends up as a pure counter term. We'll see what we can see in a minute why. And of course, if you separate an object into two of those pieces, then the renormalization of those pieces, it has to be, renormalization group has to combine information of those two pieces of the function g and k. So you can write down the renormalization group equation, which is mu dd mu, and then alpha s, beta function of alpha s, and dd alpha s. And then if you act on the function g or k, this is either plus the cusp anomalous dimension or minus the cusp anomalous dimension. So depending on which way you look at it. And if you take the upper integral, then you can solve first for mu, the evolution equation that gives you the g function as a single integral over a scale of alpha s. You can stick it in here. And then you solve for the form factor, for the log of the form factor, and you get the double integral as a final expression, which organizes all the infrared structure that is appearing there. So the log of the form factor depending on Q squared over mu squared, alpha S in epsilon, is then given as 1/2. We have an integral from 0 to Q squared over mu squared, d xi over xi. And here you have the initial condition, g of a depending on xi and epsilon, plus you have the counter term k of a, and epsilon plus, no, we have minus 1, and you go from 1 to xi, d lambda over lambda, gamma cusp of lambda, of the d-dimensional running coupling of lambda and epsilon, and this is it. So here we close that bracket here. So the double poles come from a double integral here over lambda and xi, and then all the single poles are organized here. And since this is a pure counter term, which only regularizes the infrared divergence you have over here, and the lambda integral, once you do the xi integral, you can rewrite it in a more suggestive form as an integral. So this is what I still do. So this is 2 more minutes. Function remains the same, minus, and then we can extend the integral from 0 to xi over the cusp anomalous dimension, lambda dd lambda, gamma k of a of lambda and epsilon. And now we're done. And you stick in the d-dimensional running coupling. You take what you know for the cusp anomalous dimension, and you just solve it, that generates you all the infrared structure of the form factor. So this function g controls the single poles, and due to work of Dixon, Manier, and Sturman, this function g has also been related to what they call an Eichner anomalous dimension plus 2 times the constant part of the collinear singularity in a scattering amplitude. So this is related to the piece proportional to delta 1 minus x in the diagonal splitting functions either PQQ or PGG to all orders. So this is the only piece where process dependence then enters. And if you were just calculating with Wilson lines, then this would be absent. Your single pole would be different. But if you're calculating in QCD where spin information on the particles is important, then you need to take this into account. So it's simply an add-on to the single pole, which you can extract from the delta function of the respective splitting function. And that makes the whole difference between the fact whether you consider a quark form factor or a gluon form factor. Okay, so that was the massless form factor, and that completes the story for the massless amplitudes. Now, I had this horrible long expression for the massive quark form factor, and to give that argument to you in a nutshell is the following. All that changes when going from the massless case to the massive case, you're regularizing it with a mass, you get, instead of poles, you get logarithms. And you can go through these 8 pages of formula, you can take the small mass limit, and you'll find horrible admixtures between poles and epsilons and log in the heavy quark mass, and you find double logs in the heavy quark mass at 1 loop order and then at 2 loop order. It all goes, it mixes. If we go back to this factorization ansatz here, then the massive case can be dealt with simply by requiring that you separate the scales in the small mass limit and that you put all the mass dependence in this function k. So you have a different infrared regulator now. It's no longer a pure counter term. You just take it along as such. And when you solve your evolution equation, of course, here you get an additional term, which then also appears here. So here you have no longer a function which you can simply relate to the counter term. And then, of course, your lower integration limit needs to change. So here you integrate then from xi over m squared divided by q squared to xi, because the regulator is different. And with these modifications, you can generate the complete tower of logarithmic enhancements and singular poles also in the massive form factor, which nicely organizes it. And I think that makes a connection to the content of the workshop, because in N=4 superangles, people are looking at Higgs-regulated amplitudes, where they have massive internal particles, which regularize the infrared singularities. And there are papers studying this issue of exponentiation. So Hen, Plefka, and collaborators at Humboldt University wrote some initial papers on that, and they were posing those questions, whether it exponentiates or not. To my mind, I would say, of course, it does exponentiate. You just have to find the right separation of the various momentum regions. Of course, the details of how the form factor looks like changes a bit, because the Higgs sector is not precisely the same infrared regulator as when you have heavy quark masses in the game. But in the end, you ought to be writing down very similar structural formula. That is it as far as the workshop is concerned. Once we had this insight here, that I should add, we had, having seen this simple replacements, there was a very nice way of deriving new QCD results. So we had all these massless calculations for quark